Welcome to the October podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Charles. The October issue is on the topic of traumatic brain injury. In this podcast, Dr. David Okonkwo will be speaking with Dr. Marek Czosnica, physicist at the University of Cambridge, about his group's novel approach to monitoring cerebrovascular pressure reactivity in patients with head injury.
I was going to start by asking you to define cerebral autoregulation and pressure reactivity. And then I thought we would just talk about how you're measuring pressure reactivity and how that relates to the intensive care unit for traumatic brain injury patients.
This is extremely long and complex question. So I can start with my background. My background is electronic engineering, and I've been working with neurosurgeons since I graduated in 1978 from Warsaw University of Technology, and I was lucky to meet really good colleagues and friends on the first pediatric neurointensive care or pediatric intensive care, and then neurosurgeons. So we started our work just trying to help with electronic devices. First of all, microsystems, then microcomputers, and then software development, how to catch from multimodal bedside monitoring information which would be useful for neurosurgeons and neurointensivists for better showing what's going on in a brain during acute phases or during long-lasting diseases like hydrocephalus, not only looking at the pressures like ICP or arterial blood pressure, but looking at those variables which may introduce something about the physiological or pathophysiological status, like brain compliance, like cerebral autoregulation,
yes,
like a pressure reactivity. And this is how it started. In head injured patients, it occurred that both cerebral compliance and vascular reactivity is extremely important. We started using several years ago using golden standard methods like transcranial Doppler. But transcranial Doppler is non-invasive. It's great, but unfortunately, it's very, very difficult for long-term monitoring. Why? Because you need to keep these ultrasound probes focused on middle cerebral arteries over longer time if you want to really monitor cerebral autoregulation. It worked, but it requires continuous presence by the bedside, and this is time-consuming and, of course, expensive. If you want to monitor, you need to not only to have the computer, transcranial Doppler, but also pay salary for somebody who is sitting there and doing continuous monitoring. So
it's also transcranial Doppler is also very operator dependent, so you need to have someone who's very good at it.
It is, David. But you know, with monitoring, there is a good thing, because in monitoring, from the definition, we need to have a look at changes which happen in time. For example, in transcranial Doppler, we compare changes in blood flow velocity with changes in cerebral perfusion pressure or arterial blood pressure and intracranial pressure. So once you focus the middle cerebral artery and keep it focused, you start using transcranial Doppler as a monitoring device, showing what changes in time. And this is not that much operator dependent, I can tell you. But it's difficult. Therefore, we started to think about how to measure cerebral autoregulation or reactivity of cerebral vessels without transcranial Doppler. And it was very well known from early publications of people like Michael Rosner, Randall Chestnut, my very good friend Erhard Lang, who was working with Randall Chestnut, but now he's working back in Germany, that people are looking at changes in arterial blood pressure and intracranial pressure. And one day I remember that was probably in 1995 in Australia, I met Randall Chestnut and Erhard Lang, and they told me that they are just sitting by the monitors, and if they see change in arterial blood pressure, for example, going down, and change in ICP following this going up, it means that the vessels are reactive. That has been supported by the Michael Rosner model of vasodilatory cascade. It means if vessels are reactive, we decrease arterial blood pressure, vessels dilate, cerebral blood volume increases, and providing pressure volume, intracranial pressure volume curve is steep enough, you have rise in ICP. Therefore, changes in ABP and ICP are in opposite directions. This is good reactivity. If they are passive, it means changes in arterial blood pressure produce the same direction of changes in ICP. It means vessels are not reactive. And there is a passive transmission of changes in arterial blood pressure through passive cerebral vessels.
And that would be impaired cerebral autoregulation.
Autoregulation for pressure reactivity. And then if you can do this just by watching changes in time trends on bedside screens, you can ask computer to do it, because computer can do it continuously with a good time resolution. So we started to use this with our ICM software, just asking software computers to continuously calculate correlation coefficient between slow changes in arterial blood pressure and slow waves in ICP. Positive means correlation coefficient means not good reactivity. Negative, certainly good reactivity. And then it was very, very easy to apply this over long time, forming pressure reactivity and treating pressure reactivity as a time trend, variables in pressure reactivity index is a time-depending variable. Another variable which probably adds something to measured pressures like ICP, cerebral perfusion pressure, arterial blood pressure. And this is how it started. In fact, it was nothing new. That was just the possibility of asking computer to do something useful for us.
Very simple, and yet a reflection of how complicated the process is to get to this point.
The process is certainly much more complicated than PRX can be. We call this vascular activity coefficient PRX, this pressure activity index, because this is a global index. You treat ICP as a one variable which is representative for whole brain. We know that probably there is a strong compartmentalization of intracranial pressure, particularly following head injury, when cerebrospinal fluid is not fluctuating freely and communicating and equalizing pressures everywhere in the cranium according to the Pascal law. And then we can have some compartmental differences between intracranial pressure. And moreover, we are using intraparenchymal probes. So they are also very much prone to this effect of compartmentalization. But because we are looking not at different points and not thinking about what is intracranial pressure as a number, we are treating intracranial pressure as a waveform which in this slow frequency range carries information about vascular reactivity, we are a little bit more on the safer side. And then it occurred when we started with this pressure reactivity. I remember that was probably in 1996, 97, we started to monitor this continuously. When we get our first 100 patients, my excellent PhD student, Lucius Steiner, did the first clinical retrospective study showing that PRX correlates with outcome, worse reactivity, worse outcome. And this relationship is independent on intracranial pressure and cerebral perfusion pressure. So pressure reactivity really adds additional information to brain pressures, as we are monitoring traditionally. And it correlates with severity of injury. It correlates with, that was another work done by another very good student of mine. She was Polish anesthetist, Magda Hiller. It works with CT scan, initial CT scan, and all Marshall classification. It works and shows what happens to reactivity during incidental changes, for example, like during plateau waves. According to Rosner's theory, during plateau waves, we have maximal vasodilation. If we have maximal vasodilation, we need to see the loss of pressure reactivity on the top of plateau waves. And indeed, it appeared that if you analyze PRX during plateau waves, there is a very quick change of PRX from negative values before plateau wave, and on the top of plateau waves, it goes always to values around plus one, from negative to positive. This is very, very nice supplementing of the very brilliant idea of Michael Rosner regarding this vasodilatory tartaric cascade during plateau waves.
The one of the hottest topics in neurotrauma right now is our need to individualize care of the traumatic brain injury patient. Can you give me an example of how measurement and continuous monitoring of pressure reactivity has changed the management of an individual patient?
That was attempt, and I think that we are still validating this, but that was very good idea of Lucius Steiner and by another student, Stefan Pieknik, who did modeling works. And he forecasted that such a pressure reactivity index should be the function of cerebral perfusion pressure. Too low cerebral perfusion pressure, of course, cause vasoparalysis and loss of vascular reactivity, and too high cerebral perfusion pressure cause hyperemia and also loss of vascular reactivity. And when Lucius taken this model to clinical practice, he showed exactly the same, that cerebral perfusion pressure has influence on pressure reactivity, and pressure reactivity plotted as a function of cerebral perfusion pressure gives perfectly nicely shape U-shaped curve. It means too low, it's worse reactivity, too high CPP, it's also not good reactivity, and there is somewhere optimal cerebral perfusion pressure. It means cerebral perfusion pressure which may give the best vascular conditions for vascular reactivity, as understood as a self-regulating intrinsic brain regulatory mechanism. And this can be translated to individual cases, and Lucius proposed the algorithm. Ask computer to spend 6 hours on evaluating pressure reactivity at different levels of cerebral perfusion pressure as they change spontaneously. Then try to plot the curve, PRX along y-axis, CPP along x-axis, see whether it replicates this U-shaped curve, and then minimum of PRX shows what should be optimal cerebral perfusion pressure for given patient. And then you can go for another hour, take last 4 hours or 6 hours window. It means move this window and again do evaluation of optimal cerebral perfusion pressure and try to keep your current cerebral perfusion pressure as close as it's possible to CPP optimal. And this is so-called optimization of cerebral perfusion pressure. And if you think about this, that tries to find the consensus between CPP-oriented therapy and Lund protocol.
Yes.
So we say we need to keep cerebral perfusion pressure not too low because this is ischemia, not too high because this is hyperemia, but evaluate individual cases this cerebral perfusion pressure which will be optimal from the point of view of pressure reactivity. Because we believe that if cerebral pressure reactivity works, brain can defend itself against secondary insults.
Yeah, and it's interesting in the most recent guidelines for the management of severe traumatic brain injury that were just published, the recommendations on cerebral perfusion pressure have been modified, and it still remains that the recommendation is to maintain cerebral perfusion pressure above 60, but in cases where patients have impaired cerebral autoregulation, those patients probably need a lower CPP than otherwise. And in folks who have a normal cerebral autoregulation, then perhaps their brains actually want a slightly higher CPP, maybe 65, maybe 70. The problem is that we do not have a good, reliable method of measuring cerebral autoregulation and pressure reactivity. And that is where I think your work is so important, and how your work will influence the field tremendously in the coming years, is when we can actually roll out this process, methodology, technology, whatever you want to call it, to more and more centers, that we can calculate what the ideal CPP is for that individual patient, rather than just taking all patients with severe head injury and say, keep their CPP above 60. You have to understand the physiology at that particular point in time in that particular patient to say, we want a cerebral perfusion pressure of X, which is ideal for this patient right now. And it may even be different tomorrow.
It may change in time.
Yeah, it may be different tomorrow. It may be different this evening. But right now, this patient's physiology in this patient's injured brain is looking for a cerebral perfusion pressure of X.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, I mean, this is a very good concept, but we still need to go through a phase of prospective, probably randomized trial. Because so far, the concept is very good, probably very good. It's feasible from the point of view of the computer methodology, but we still need to have proof that it really works in clinical practice. There was a trial, or they started to make the trial based on this methodology in University of Brescia in Italy. I think that unfortunately that was only one center, and one center was not able to produce enough data to make it conclusive. But what they found, as far as I remember now sitting, however I may be not very precise, that they showed that they were not able to show that it improves outcome, but they were able to show that it dramatically reduced amount of vasopressors given to get a similar outcome for head injured patients.
That's very interesting.
And this is great.
If you wanted the reader of this excellent paper to take home one lesson, what would it be?
One important lesson is that the pressure activity, it's brain most important intrinsic neuroprotective mechanism, and we need to care about reactivity of vessels. As we know, we can care, for example, using statins in stroke or after subarachnoid hemorrhage. With the continuous monitoring of pressure reactivity, we can be much, much wiser from the point of view where we are and how far from optimal management we are.
Excellent.
And that would be the message.
Thank you very much for your time, and
thank you
for your excellent paper.
Thank you, David. That's not my paper. The paper is written by one of my most promising students, Dr. Christian Zweifel, who is from Switzerland, sitting with us, having a great interest in those problems of pressure reactivity. So hopefully quite soon his name will be also important in the field of clinical neurosciences.
Excellent. We look forward to more data from the group. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. It was a pleasure.
This concludes our podcast for the October issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the November issue, when the topic will be acute spinal cord injury. For more information on how to submit your research to Neurosurgical Focus, or to see a list of upcoming topics, please visit thejns.org and click on Neurosurgical Focus. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.